Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Spooks, The Haunting of America, The Private Use of Secret Agents, by Jim Hogan, narrated by William Saras. Introduction. It seems fitting that in a country where people aspire of two of everything, cars, kids, and homes, we should have two histories as well. And so we do. A public chronicle, or Disney version, so widely available as to be unavoidable, and a second one that remains secret, buried, and unnamed. Lately, Americans have come to suspect the existence of this second history, the Watergate affair, with all its resonances and subsequent snippets of CIA malpractices, have disinterred a part of the Times. Spooks is an effort at further excavation in an area that has long been identified as terra incognita, the private use of secret agents by multinational corporations and the rich. Our subject, then, is not the CIA, but Mission Impossible agencies, whose clandestine expertise is available to the highest bidder. As we'll see, agents from the federal intelligence community have entered private practice by the tens of thousands, impinging invisibly but profoundly on current events and our perception of them. The specter they raise is one of a country haunted by its wandering spooks, much as Japan was formerly haunted by itinerant samurai cut loose from baronial service. The prospect this presents is an unhappy one in which the federal bureaucracy is compromised by its own veterans, intelligence agents working in behalf of what threatens to become a multinational Raj, a world whose borders are marked not by loyalties, but by the secret transits of company spies, the ebb and flood of laundered currencies. Preventing that prospect from becoming a reality is predictably a matter of full disclosure. Light has always been the most dependable means of exorcism. So it is that the haunting of America will end only when our secret history becomes public knowledge. Spooks is a mere beginning in that process of illumination, but the task is likely to be pursued. It is, after all, literally intriguing, and the subjects of our reportage quite worthy of fiction. Consider, for instance, Alan Bell. Sitting behind his desk in the Virginia headquarters of Dector Counterintelligence Incorporated, Colonel Bell explains the significance of the Chinese fighting wand awarded to him 20 years before. It's a baleful baton, 16 inches of petrified wood with knobby skulls carved in either end. One skull is white, the other black, alluding to some lethal metaphysic of the Orient. Bell earned it in Korea, where he says he became the first Western black belt in Kung Fu. There's no reason to doubt him. The walls of his office are hung with mysterious memorabilia, photos of Bell instructing King Constantine in the nuances of karate, a samurai sword, examples of Oriental calligraphy, and other exotica. On the desk in front of him is a switchblade that he uses to open mail, a bundle of tape cassettes, three Ewer tape recorders, and a pile of charts made with the Psychological Stress Evaluator, PSE, an invention of his and two other former Army intelligence officers. Across the hall is an office filled with locks of every conceivable kind, and three doors farther down is a room packed with state-of-the-art counter-surveillance devices. All the offices at Dector are equipped with metal blinds, whose purpose is not so much to soften the lighting as it is to counter eavesdroppers. Alan Bell is a spook. So is Robert Mayhew. Dressed like a French banker, Mayhew radiates presence, that combination of authority and savoir-faire associated with great actors and a handful of world-class gangsters and tennis players. Entering a Washington restaurant at Mayhew's side is like arriving in the jungles of New Guinea. The ordinary clamor of the place stiffens to a sudden silence. You can feel the stares pressing on your back, the whispers washing around you. At a nearby table, a woman mentions the names Onassis, Hughes, and Nyarkos to her companion. Waiters approach like tentative bushmen, half bowed in their anxiety to please. A bottle of vintage wine arrives, compliments of the restaurant's owner, who begs to be remembered but doesn't want to disturb. Operating in a milieu that places an extravagant value on anonymity, Bob Mayhew is that strangest of things, a clandestine celebrity, a spook with solid gold cufflinks. Mitch Werbel doesn't wear cufflinks, but if he did, they'd probably contain explosives. The cane he carries conceals a small but serviceable sword. His swagger stick doubles as a rocket launcher. When he's on a business trip, his attaché case is neatly fitted with the tools of his trade, a featherweight submachine gun nestled in deep velvet beside a specially designed silencer. Together, they're capable of squeezing off 800 rounds of ammunition in a minute of almost perfectly preserved quiet. Werbel is a spook who specializes in the crafts of assassination and the freelance coup d'etat. He loves his work. So did Bobby Hall love the work he did, until, if you can believe the wavering testimony of a somewhat dubious cop, a Jewish pornographer from Shanghai put an end to it. A corrupt private investigator, drug dealer, and wiretapping specialist, Hall was a man obsessed with intrigue. Blackmailing Robert Vesco and playing middleman in a bizarre burglary of Howard Hughes' inner sanctum, the Hollywood spook came to a Raymond Chandler ending on a hot summer night in 1976. Found on the floor of his kitchen with three Bing cherries in his mouth and a .38 slug in the back of his head, Hall left a legacy to his family of incandescent tape recordings that police have sworn to bum. Another piece of America's secret history is held by a reporter who formerly covered the news for the Washington Post and currently works for another news publication. As we'll see, he played an instrumental and witting role in a conspiracy mounted by Richard Nixon against one of the world's wealthiest and most glamorous men. With CIA officers, freelance secret agents, and others at his command, the reporter shuttled between European capitals on his silent mission, while spooks at home supported his operations with calculated smears, surveillance teams, and an explosive wiretap in New York. The identity of that reporter spy will be revealed later on. So will his statements laying the operation at the feet of a man who is currently one of the country's most powerful and prestigious public officials. Suffice to say here, however, that the operation I've referred to was an affair of profound historical resonance, a prelude to Watergate, in which future political shocks might easily have been divined, had only we known at the time the degree to which both history and the public are subject to the spook's manipulations. Nixon, of course, has always had an affection for intrigue and a propensity for getting caught at it. The effect of this has been to make the former president seem unique, a political aberration. In fact, however, Nixon's intrigues were complemented in full by his more likable counterparts in the Democratic Party. As we'll discuss later on, the Kennedys also had an affection for spooks, and, according to sources in and out of government, used White House discretionary funds to establish an archipelago of private intelligence agencies designed to further their political ends. Bob Palekin, president of International Intelligence Incorporated, Intertel, is no stranger to intrigue either, presiding over a private apparat whose ranks are filled with tradecraft specialists and executive spies called from the highest echelons of the federal intelligence community. Nicknamed the Needle, the lean and lawyerly Palekin operates in a milieu of pulp dimensions, a world of billionaires, hydrofoils, seaplanes, baccarat, and listless casuarina trees. Jack Holcomb is another spook, one who tried to sew up the tiny island of Anguilla, but saw his needlework undone by a battalion of British paratroopers. He could take solace, however, in his realization of another dream, the creation in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, of the National Intelligence Academy and Surveillance City. The latter is an enormous scale model of an average American community upon which teams of apprentice agents practice the gray arts of electronic eavesdropping, dedicated to a vision of total surveillance. Leaning over the tiny streets in quiet conversation, they deploy batteries of mini-mics, cameras, and laser devices across a spectrum of unlikely places, sewers, drain pipes, street lamps, etc. And then there's John J. Frank, also known as John Kane, the former CIA officer whom no one seems to want to talk about, except to ask, when does he get out? Bell, Mayhew, Werbel, and the others, they seem implausible, characters from the cheapest sort of fiction. Where else but in a James Bond novel would one find someone with the skills of Alan Bell? An archetype of the master spy, Bell is certifiably lethal with his hands, a master of Chinese knife fighting, a crack shot, brilliant interrogator, and legendary inventor of spy tech. To add that he is also something of a mystic, interested in ESP and the Dharma, is to tempt credulity too far. Yet Robert Mayhew is drawn with an equally broad brush. Who else but Ian Fleming would create a spook whose Mission Impossible agency, for such is what it was, would earn him more than $500,000 per year in his role as alter ego to a cadaverous and demented billionaire who was, for his part, determined to rule the world from a dark and malodorous hotel room in Las Vegas. And Werbel, like a man in love with death, he has spent his life courting it. A specialist in the development of assassination devices, he moves from one world capital to another, arranging coup d'etat, while flogging the most murderous devices he can invent to fugitive millionaires and third world fascists alike. It's all legal, whatever its morality, and if the weapons filter down to the commandants of political death squads, men whom Werbel admits he probably knows, it's none of his affair, so long as his papers are in order and his client's politics are right. Spooks. The word is gray and vaguely mocking, filled with grammatical twilight. There is an ambiguity about it, a lack of definition. On the one hand, it denotes nothing more than someone skilled in the practices of intelligence. On the other hand, depending on the circumstances, it may suggest an elusive mixture of force, deception, and intrigue. Black humor, too. Dirty tricks, after all, are a part of the trade, and no matter how dirty, they're still tricks. The lethal light bulbs and exploding telephone receivers dreamed up by the B.R. Fox Company are, in essence, practical jokes, albeit of a deadly kind. And spooks, the word itself, moving in and out of fashion, interchangeable with players and swingers, is the source of so many in-jokes that one would rather not do without it. Norm Casper, for instance, the Tums-popping private eye who uncovered Richard M. Nixon's secret bank account in the Bahamas, is, in deference to the word, referred to by colleagues as the friendly ghost. And there is humor, too, although of a special kind, in the person of John P. Muldoon. A sepulchral giant with a slate-gray flat top, Muldoon retired from the CIA in 1972, at the age of 34, ending a career of overseas service that saw him posted from Scandinavia to Germany, Laos, Thailand, Vietnam, and Korea. Chain-smoking Lucky Strikes and drinking Budweiser's serially in a small restaurant near the White House, Muldoon recalls with a chuckle his work for the Washington Post's liberal publisher, Katharine Graham. During the 1975 Pressman strike, the John P. Muldoon Detective Agency, comprised almost exclusively of ex-CIA officers from the clandestine services, was hired by the Wackenhut Corporation to provide security for Mrs. Graham and other executives at the Post. About 20 of Muldoon's spooks were given plainclothes assignments that placed them round the clock in the execs' living rooms. It was uncomfortable, Muldoon remembers, pointing out the awkwardness of the situation. These were really nice homes, he says. The family would eat dinner, the kids would be playing, and there, sitting on the couch, would be me or some other guy from the agency. Big, you know, and checking his gun. It was sort of tense. We didn't really fit in. I'll tell you, some of those people were real shits about it. Katharine Graham wouldn't even let us in. She wanted my man to sit outside on a cot in the cold all night. I wouldn't let him. I mean, who the hell does she think she is? The pressman bothered Muldoon even more. Coming home one morning, he found his car filled with garbage, and a threatening message painted on his hood. Infuriated, he called a friend in New Jersey who's very well connected to both the unions and, well, organized crime, and I told him that I had a list of 12 union leaders here in Washington. If anyone fucked with me or my family or anything of mine, I was going to take out 3 of the bastards at the exact same time, as a warning. If anything else happened, I was going to hit the other 9 all at once. I told him I didn't care if those guys were responsible or not. I was holding them responsible, and he'd better get the word out. I was not bullshitting either. I would have done it. I know guys inside the agency, and guys who'd left who could do that, and they would, too. I offered, as a demonstration, to abduct 3 of them, union people, and hold them for an hour, just to show that I was serious. But he took the hint. Nothing ever happened after that. Muldoon smiles and admits that the abduction, had it taken place, would have been embarrassing to the Post's publisher. But then he shrugs. What the hell? If they can hit my car, they can hit my family. Applied equally to Norm Casper, Bob Pelican, and John Muldoon, Spooks refers to an almost incongruous mixture of personalities. Nevertheless, the word is apropos. America has become a haunted place as its intelligence agents move from the federal campus to the more profitable private sector, bringing burn bags, bugs, scramblers, covers, conduits, and codes to an array of business activities ranging from labor negotiations to mergers and sales. The Spooks are making a financial killing while transforming the way business is done, American style. Their clients are the premier crew of the financial establishment: Hughes, Hunt, Rockefeller, Getty, Ford, Nyarkos, Graham, Mellon. Institutional clients have also piled up: Exxon, IBM, ITT, Chase Manhattan, General Motors, American Express, Northrop, Bell Telephone, the Marriott Corporation. Indeed, most of the Fortune 500 can be said to swing. Even the McDonald's hamburger chain has become a player, putting Intertel on retainer. Behind the billowing costume and the playful visage of the Ronald McDonald clown is the expertise of some 60 spooks whose apprenticeship at the FBI, CIA, and National Security Agency, NSA, allows them to command $50 an hour per agent for their services. Elsewhere, the Lockheed Corporation entered upon an espionage bender, hiring Manchurian spies, Ivy League bagmen, and even a Japanese assassin to help sell its planes. Nor are the spooks' clients uniformly conservative in their politics. Employing the Wackenhut Corporation, which boasts of its sophisticated strike service, the liberal Katherine Graham found herself in very strange company. An enormous private intelligence agency cum guard service, Wackenhut was founded by retiring FBI agents whose conservatism was immediately apparent. For years, Wackenhut relied on the dossiers of the Church League of America, a right-wing think tank whose intelligence files on the left undoubtedly include volumes about Mrs. Graham herself. Neither is the Post's publisher the only liberal to realize the value of an investment in spooks. Stuart Mott, eccentric angel of the American left, was for years the secret partner of Mitch Werbel, financing the paramilitarists' development of assassination devices in Georgia. Mott, strangely enough, is a director of the Fund for Peace, and explains his involvement with silencers and submachine guns in environmental terms, an explanation that will be elaborated later on. What's happened is that private CIAs for hire, established after World War II, have metastasized across the landscape. Whether it's computers, hamburgers, newspapers, or jets, America's paladin spooks are increasingly likely to have a hand in it, and sometimes a strong arm as well. Occasionally, their work benefits the public, though only incidentally. More often, the public is their target, and even when no laws are broken, justice is often undone. Subverting federal agencies in the courts with the promise of future jobs and the exploitation of contracts, industry's intelligence agents often labor in a moral vacuum. Profit, rather than patriotism, is their assignment. And, not infrequently, laws are broken. Smears, bag jobs, bribes, wiretaps, deception operations, currency scams, industrial espionage, tax frauds, and even assassination programs have been planned and carried out by contract agents of the business world. The dimensions of the phenomenon are difficult to gauge. It's like measuring the perimeter of an expanding fog. But there are indications. Senator William Proxmire, for instance, has pegged the number of employees in the federal intelligence community at 148,000. It's from these ranks that the shock troops of the private intelligence agencies come, though Proxmire's number is itself a conservative one. The intelligence community is officially defined as including only those organizations that are members of the U.S. Intelligence Board, USIB. A dozen other agencies, charged with both foreign and domestic intelligence chores, are not encompassed by the term. Nor are tens of thousands of contract employees and agents working undercover, or otherwise unsalaried, included in the senator's estimation. The bustling community described by Proxmire is in fact no more than a suburb of a much larger metropolis that may be compared to a secret Pittsburgh in our midst. The number of intelligence workers employed by the federal government is not 148,000, but some undetermined multiple of that number. And if to this elusive figure we add those spooks who are privately employed as in-house or contract agents and investigators, it becomes apparent that the intelligence fraternity is enormous, whatever its exact size may be. There are, in the United States, some 32,000 licensed private investigators working outside government, and more than 4,200 registered firms specializing in security work of various kinds. The number of unlicensed detectives would swell those figures considerably. Not only is the enforcement of licensing laws lax in many states, but an even dozen have so far failed to impose any form of regulation whatsoever. In any case, a minority of spooks choose to call themselves detectives, viewing the licensing laws as an unnecessary bother and the image as a burden. Their services are often more sophisticated than a mere investigator can provide, and as a result, many prefer to incorporate under a more general rubric. Intertel, for instance, can be found in the Yellow Pages under Management Consultants. They are, however, spooks par excellence. Of these 4,200 firms, five account for more than half the revenue earned in the field. At least, they're said to. The truth is that no one can be certain how much money is involved, if only because many private apparats shun written agreements, preferring oral contracts for security reasons. This book, however, is not concerned with the majority of these firms, their income deriving primarily from rent-a-guard and armored car services. Nevertheless, it's worth pointing out that in-house and contract guards number more than 250,000 and are part of an industry that grosses in excess of $5 billion annually. Nor is this book concerned with those private detectives, for example, Julian J.J. Arms, who deliberately create an unjustified aura of mystery about themselves and their work. The accoutrements of intrigue are, for them, a commodity that proves useful in selling themselves to the credulous and easily impressed. In fact, most private investigators are engaged in thoroughly banal activities. Skip tracing, the search for guru-struck teenagers, marital espionage, and so forth. Such matters are of only incidental account. Surveillance, of course, is a concern of this book. Sabre Laboratories President Leo Jones is correct when he declares that society today is on a surveillance binge, citing the fact that for every bugging device in the hands of government, there are 300 in the private sector. Indeed, surveillance has become such a routine of Western life that we pay it hardly any attention. In the banks, supermarkets, department stores, and airports, we're watched, sometimes by kindly eyes, always by hidden ones, and have become accustomed to it. The technology and methods used in this effort have in many cases been developed by the intelligence community and its graduates. But it isn't only in the streets and stores that we're overseen and monitored. Security agencies such as Fidelifax often place undercover agents in offices and on the assembly line, there to report to management upon their coworkers' behavior, attitudes, loyalty, and performance. To this day, General Motors, Lordstown, Ohio workers don't realize that they were up against Intertel as well as GM during their 1972 strike. Should we apply for credit or a job, the Metropolitan Bureau of Investigation Incorporated, Uffinger's or Mitchell Reports, may well be hired to conduct a covert background investigation in addition to the usual checks we've come to accept from credit reporting services. Meanwhile, at home, our telephones are monitored at the absolute discretion of the Surveillance Observance Bureau, SOB, a section of the Bell system. With literally millions of wiretaps in unregulated operation, 125,000 in Manhattan alone during a single year, SOB's network of former FBI agents and others sometimes works in close liaison with police and private individuals who have, on occasion, traded and sold information obtained from the taps. By no means, finally, the psychiatric invasion of our privacy can be accomplished almost anywhere by means of the Psychological Stress Evaluator, PSE, a lie-detecting device available from Dector Counterintelligence Incorporated. Developed for CIA and Army intelligence units, the PSE requires neither contact with nor the consent of the subject. Stress and truthfulness can be measured remotely using tape recordings made without the subject's knowledge. And if an individual has cable television, which usually relies on the existing wiring of the phone company, an optical wiretap can be installed to observe his actions in the home. Presumably, Ma Bell's Service Observance Bureau will find reason to monitor the movements of selected customers, just as it monitors their speech. With the exception of some wiretapping equipment, the tools of surveillance are as near as the local Radio Shack or Christmas catalog, a parabolic microphone capable of recording songbirds a half mile away is available from Edmund Scientific, Barrington, New Jersey, for $299. An Infinity transmitter, billed as an anti-burglary device, can be had from Law Enforcement Associates Incorporated, also of New Jersey. Ask for the Tele-Ear, about $400. The state of the eavesdropper's art, moreover, is such that private conversations and movements in the home can be recorded orally and optically without breaking the law. All one needs is the wherewithal to rent the services of spooks to operate sophisticated equipment, lasers, and other devices unforeseen by antiquated legislation. What's happened is that the technology of surveillance has outraced the evolution of laws designed to regulate it, subordinating our rights of privacy to mere suspicion and the quest for private advantage. It's not my intention to suggest that all of us are monitored most of the time. We aren't. Nor do I mean to imply that we've arrived at a state of affairs resembling a corporate police state. We haven't. The technology needed to realize Orwell's worst nightmares is available, poorly regulated, and widely abused, but so far the United States has escaped its full potential. Elsewhere, particularly in such totalitarian laboratories as Paraguay, Nicaragua, and the Philippines, 1984 is a fait accompli. What's preserved the United States from the fate of some small nations is, of course, its democratic institutions and a cantankerous public, jealous of its rights. A great deal of attention has understandably been paid to the federal government's malpractices in the areas of intelligence and surveillance, especially to the activities of the FBI and CIA. Indeed, a president and his advisors have been shamed from office, and reforms within the intelligence community are said to have begun. Very little, however, is known about the commercial sector, whose internal operations are regarded as privileged and which are easily hidden from view. The dangers inherent in that privilege are many, and we pay for them every day. A businessman pays when his trade secrets are stolen by spies and when his reputation is ruined by artful rumor. The taxpayer pays when spooks use their government contracts and offshore connections to undermine legal proceedings against their clients or to enable those clients to evade taxes. The union member pays when corporate spies bug collective bargaining sessions, subjecting the union's position to the scrutiny of a PSE, betraying the union's bargaining position and the bottom line of its demands. The consumer pays when, without knowing it, he's brainwashed by commercially exploited propaganda techniques developed by spooks working in psychological warfare laboratories. The job applicant pays when he's blackballed on the basis of politically oriented dossiers compiled by industrial sleuths.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?